From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Jack Beatty, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
You're clear out of this world.
Singer, dancer, actor, impersonator, and rat packer, Sammy Davis Jr. was a marathon performer who gave his all to audiences. Sammy lived the highs and lows of a life in show business that began when he was three. He collected jewelry, wives, death, controversy, and praise. But behind the tireless performer was a man haunted by abandonment, racism, and addiction. A new biography looks beyond the footlights to an African-American man who broke through in Ike's America and managed to stay on top. Tonight, On Point, Sammy Davis Jr., A Life in Black and White.
After.
What are your memories of Sammy Davis Jr. when he sang, danced, and told jokes? Were you laughing with or at him? Did Sammy Davis Jr. break ground for African-American artists or perpetuate old stereotypes? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from a stop on his book tour in Denver is Will Haygood, staff writer for The Washington Post and author of In Black and White, The Life of Sammy Davis Jr. Will, it's awfully good to talk to you again.
Thank you very much. Likewise.
And this book is fascinating. I spent too much of the day reading it and didn't get behind on my other work.
Wow.
Let's just begin with a sort of basic question I think people always have about authors of biography. Mm-hmm. Why were you drawn to Sammy Davis Jr.?
It seemed such a life that had been imprisoned by the Rat Pack history. He seemed to be in this odd, strange tunnel as if his life only existed against the backdrop of Frank Sinatra and Dean Martin and the Rat Pack. And there was so much more to his life. It was so secretive in one way, so epic in another way, and it seemed to be a life that had been trapped in mockery and that needed a serious writer to take a serious look at it.
Trapped in mockery, partly self-mockery?
Well, I think some of it was. He came out of vaudeville, and in vaudeville, the number one thing that you had to do was to endure, to stay on stage every night. You had to convince the nightclub owner that you had the chops and the skills to keep audience members in the seats for, you know, 2 weeks or 3 weeks. So I think Sammy did things throughout his life to stay on stage, to stay underneath those bright lights.
And whatever it took, he was going to get that audience's attention.
Yes. He was foremost an entertainer. Someone like him who starts out in show business at the age of three and who grows up with his father as part of the act, I think he would always see that his success would be a help to his father, and if he failed, it might doom his father. So there was nothing that Sammy was not willing to do to stay on stage. Actually, he confused reality and fiction with being on stage. Thus, his life was full of genuine contradiction.
Now, on stage, was that primarily on stage before white audiences? Was there a kind of racial division in among his fans?
Yes. Now, Sammy was very shrewd that way. In the mid-40s, after service in the Army, Sammy envisioned himself in nightclubs, east, west, and north. He was afraid of the South. But by going to these nightclubs in Philadelphia, in Syracuse, New York, in Cincinnati, he had ingratiated himself to white people. And thus, they could look at Sammy as kind of a member of their extended family. We went last night to see this great kid, this young entertainer, Sammy Davis Jr. Now, most of the high-tier, sophisticated nightclubs in the 50s were white. Mm-hmm. And Sammy loved recruiting new admirers. So at the end of the 50s, America, white America, knew Sammy as almost somebody like Ken. It was very shrewd on his part.
Mm-hmm. Now, give us you've got a marvelous passage about little Sammy, about his days when he was winning these audiences as a child performer. Let's hear that.
Little Sammy Davis Jr. was floating in the performer's life, eyeing train schedules like coloring books, and watching old vaudevillians slump into sleep on moving trains, listening to the modulated tones of the Pullman porters, the names of cities spilling from their mouths like clipped music, their chained pocket watches glistening, seeing snowflakes fall, eyes widening at new automobiles gliding down the streets, staring at leaves being windblown on autumn afternoons, watching men slide nickels across countertops for the morning newspaper, smiling at the pretty women who'd smile at him, falling off to sleep as the covers were pulled up close to his shoulders in bed, all the while staring into the whites of the eyes of those who cared so much for him, his father in the vaudevillian Will Maston. The little boy was so free and yet so caged in the world of show business. Will Maston and Sam Sr. were as kind, as tender, and as attentive as they could be. In a way, they gave little Sammy everything. And with that, they simply bartered away his childhood.
Sammy never went to school.
Never went to school a day in his life.
Mm. And that was a source of insecurity lifelong for him, wasn't it? Even though he clearly was a very bright man. I mean,
yes, it was. And so he learned in these theaters, and he learned in movie houses, watching film. He had a strange young boy's life. There was no stickball. There was no softball. There was no choice in what he would do. He would perform. He would be up some nights till midnight, and he had a job to do in New York City, in St. Louis, in Denver, all over the country.
And you have a very poignant scene in 1941 where he goes to see his mother, who's in another show in Boston. She was a chorus girl, and he was pretty much a motherless child, wasn't he?
He was. He had went to see some entertainers at this theater there, and he was in the wings, and he was looking, and he was astonished. He didn't really think he was seeing who he was seeing, and he was. It was Elvira Davis, Sammy Davis Jr.'s mother, who had left him at the age of 3 to chase her own vaudeville dreams. And I think forever there after, there was a deep hole in his heart, Sammy. Yes, he had money, he had fame, but of course most mothers will go into the jaws mm-hmm. of a lion to get their child. Sammy Davis's mother simply went the other way.
Mm. We have a performance next of Sammy. Can we hear it?
I knew a man, Bojangles, and he danced for you. In worn-out shoes, with silver hair, a ragged shirt, and baggy pants. He would do the old soft shoe. He could jump so high. Jump so high, and then he lightly touched down.
Sammy Davis Jr. singing Mr. Bojangles. Bill Bojangles Robinson taught Sammy how to dance, didn't he? Well, I was down and
out. Yes, he did, and I mean, that was wonderful. I mean, just think of a kid learning to dance from a giant like that. I mean, you know, it was the highest of the high. I mean, you could not go to anyone any better to learn how to tap dance than Bill Bojangles Robinson.
And he was a sort of forerunner, wasn't he? Bojangles was of the Hollywood stereotype of the black man. How did Sammy negotiate that role over the years?
Very well. He started out in L.A. in Hollywood, going to various nightclubs with a camera, taking photographs of the white Hollywood stars, James Cagney, Humphrey Bogart, Jimmy Stewart. And he would send these photographs to people with a letter introducing himself and his Will Mastin trio, his act. And, I mean, that was very shrewd on Sammy's part. I mean, he was a fan. And so by the end of the 1940s, these stars knew that there was this kid who was black in their midst, who was sending them photographs and letters introducing himself. It was very shrewd on Sammy's part, and some of his friends who were black thought he was trying too hard. But, and then again, he's a vaudevillian. He'll do anything to get his name in lights and to keep it there.
And he really emulated other people's acts, didn't he, as well as their accents?
Yes, he was a great mimic. And it was rare in those days to have an entertainer who was black stand up on a stage and impersonate Dean Martin or Jerry Lewis.
Or Cary Grant, I remember.
Or Cary Grant. I mean, that was just, it was novel, it was new, it was smart. Sammy, I think, knew, absent civil rights laws, that all he had to fall back on was talent.
And he had it in abundance. We're talking tonight with Will Haygood, author of a new biography of Sammy Davis Jr. In the background, The Candyman, Sammy's number one hit single from 1972. How do you remember Sammy Davis Jr.? Do you see him as an African-American performer or just a performer? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point.
Candyman can, 'cause he mixes it with love and makes the world taste good.
Makes the world taste good.
Who can take a rainbow?
Who can take a rainbow?
Wrap it in a sigh.
Wrap it in a sigh.
Soak it in the sun and make a groovy lemon pie. The Candyman.
The Candyman.
The Candyman can.
The Candyman can,
'cause he mixes it with love and makes the world taste good.
This is On Point. I'm Jack Beatty, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking with Will Haygood, author of King of the Cats, The Life and Times of Adam Clayton Powell, Jr., The Haygoods of Columbus, a family memoir, and a new biography of Sammy Davis, Jr. Tonight, the fractured life of Sammy Davis, Jr., a black man who became a star in white America during the 1950s and 60s. Did Sammy Davis, Jr. break new ground for African-American artists or perpetuate old stereotypes? Would you be surprised to know that Sammy Davis, Jr. was a secret supporter of the civil rights movement? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking with Will Haygood, author of In Black and White, The Life of Sammy Davis, Jr. Will, this is one of the pieces of news in your book, that Sammy Davis, Jr., who was called by some an Uncle Tom, who was criticized for marrying white women and romancing white women, who had the white friends in the Rat Pack and who was sort of thought of as part of that, that this same man was a, you call him, a kind of a secret financial weapon of the civil rights movement. Tell us about that.
Yes, he was. Harry Belafonte, who I interviewed during the 5 years of working on this book, told me that Martin Luther King Jr. had a favorite expression when he was jailed. He would turn to Harry Belafonte and say, "Get Sammy." And I asked Harry Belafonte what that meant, and he said it meant that King knew we could ask Sammy Davis Jr., wherever he was at, to send money, and Sammy would stage a fundraiser or turn to the nightclub owner and say, "I want the receipts tonight to be sent to Dr. Martin Luther King." Harry Belafonte said that Sammy Davis Jr. for 12, 13, 14, 15 years would send $8,000 every other week. And he said this is a great unknown story about the civil rights movement. And I was simply astonished. And I think it was Sammy's way of doing what he could do. He could produce cash. He couldn't change people's image about who he dated or who he married, but he could send money, and money could spring people from jail. Money could keep the SCLC moving forward. Money could keep King on the road. So money was important, and Sammy knew it, and he made a lot of money.
So as much as perhaps $15,000 or maybe even $20,000 a month, or sometimes for 10 years.
Yes,
this is
yes.
A lot of money.
That's a lot of money, and I think Sammy deep down inside, he was very proud of that. But in 1965, at the apex of the modern civil rights movement, he was in a stage play in New York, Golden Boy, and his leading lady was white. So that's his life on stage. Off stage, he's married to Mae Britt, who's also white. So I think many blacks were unable to separate the two, Sammy's on stage life and off stage life and what he did to help Martin Luther King Jr. They really didn't care that he was a big financial benefactor in the civil rights movement. Many blacks seemed to be angry that his world was, for the most part, white.
Now that raises, you talk a lot about that, and you have just a quote from you. You said, you write, "Sammy Davis Jr. loved the sight of white women on his black silk sheets." Tell us about that.
He did. Well, see, he came of age sexually in Canada, where his father and the other vaudevillian Will Mastin traveled mm-hmm. In the early 40s. So both of those men had white girlfriends. Mm. And Sammy saw that. And he wanted to transfer that south without a knowledge of the historical pain and danger of that. And I also think you can maybe read something very vivid here. And as well, his mother, who was black, abandoned him. Mm-hmm. I think Sammy had some kind of sad, unfortunate fear or loathing of women who were black. That's just a simple truth.
Mm-hmm. And one of the women he was very close to, had an affair with, was Kim Novak. And his life was really threatened, sounds like partly by the studio, partly by the mob, to break that off.
Yes. And I mean, this was at a time when studios never had to deal with issues such as one of their white starlets dating someone who was black. It was just unheard of, and it just made the studio very extremely nervous, and Sammy was threatened. And Sammy's mindset was extremely cinematic. He watched movies, and he thought that the actors in movies were really who they were. He really lived his whole life looking at the big screen. And so when somebody from a studio threatened him and told him that that he would not have a successful career any longer, I think he went back to thinking, I must do anything I can to stay on stage. And so the affair ended with Miss Novak, and Sammy ran out and married a woman who was black. A bizarre marriage that lasted only 6 months.
And he didn't really even know her.
No, he didn't. Lorraine White was her name. She mm-hmm. was a lounge singer in Las Vegas.
Mm-hmm. Let's have a clip from the film, the 1960 film Ocean's 11. In this scene, Danny Ocean, played by Frank Sinatra, is about to lay down the plan for a big heist. Peter Lawford, Dean Martin, Sinatra, and Sammy are doing their things, with Sammy bringing Little Rock into the mix.
You like to explain that, Professor?
No, it's simple. By turning money into power. I think I'll buy me some votes and go into politics.
Hey, now that's a good idea, baby boy. You'd make a good notary public.
I'm the one that's going into politics.
What's going to be your platform, Big Sam?
Repeal the 14th and the 20th Amendment, take the vote away from the women, and make slaves out of them.
Hey, now that's something that's real constructive.
Yep.
Hey, will it cost much?
Oh, no, we'd have the price controls. No inflation on slaves.
Vote for Sam Harmon. Help stamp out mental health.
You got a better platform?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Pay off your own party. Settle for an appointment.
Yeah, now that's real deep thinking. Gentlemen, I'd like for you to meet our latest senator.
What a terrible thought. Why don't you become an ambassador? You could be a big man in some foreign country.
No, make that a little foreign country. We don't want a big enemy.
Yeah. A little country like Andorra.
Or Pomona.
What about Little Rock?
That's a scene from Ocean's 11, one of the Rat Pack movies. Will Haygood, what's going on in these movies with all this racial badinage?
Sammy could not find roles in the studio movies. He was not tall enough. He was often told he was not handsome enough. He had one eye. And so he leaned on his good friend Frank Sinatra. And of course, these weren't really great movies, but they were movies where Sammy had a role at long last in studio films. And Frank Sinatra and Dean Martin and Sammy joked a lot offstage about race. Those awkward moments often translated as awkwardly onto film. But it was interesting with the Rat Pack. Without Sammy, in the Rat Pack, it's just four white guys on stage or screen. So Sammy, in an odd way, gave the Rat Pack a kind of a social mindset. The audiences out there all of a sudden saw an integrated group. I mean, you did not see a lot of blacks on TV in film in the early 1960s, but you did see Sammy Davis Jr.
And yet, though this was an advantage for him, the Rat Pack, as you show it, was sort of a dead end as well.
Yes, it was. Sammy, I think, often had to subsume his talent on stage with Frank Sinatra and Dean Martin. And think of that. I mean, he could not soar on the stage every night with them because they would shoot him a very cold look. He was so gifted. He was versatile. Mm. On a live nightclub stage, he could blow them out of the water. But he couldn't do that because he would make them angry. So he had to limit his explosiveness on stage with them. I find that to be somewhat sad.
That is sad. And you talk about the polarity from Dean Martin, the minimalist, to Sammy, who
yes.
gave it everything. And in fact, you say that at some points he actually gave back $1,000 tickets to audiences to whom he didn't feel he gave enough.
Yes. And that's true. He worked so hard on stage. That really was his wonderful gift. He was a true entertainer. He never liked to be introduced. He would just walk out on stage very quietly, and people would still be fidgeting in their seats. And they would see him, and they would go, "Oh, ooh, ah, there he is. Look, there he is. There's Sammy Davis Jr." And he would pick up the microphone, and he would say, "Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Sammy Davis Jr." And they would go crazy.
He didn't have to tell anybody who he was.
No,
Let's take a call from Dennis in Fitchburg, Massachusetts. Hello and welcome.
Well, thank you. I'm a little nervous. I hope this works out all right.
Okay.
There was a nightclub in Boston years ago. It was called Blenstrom's.
Oh, yeah.
And my mother worked there, and I would occasionally get in, you know, like coming home. I went to school in Boston to eat dinner on my way home, and I saw a number of people, and I was lucky enough to see Sammy Davis. I think his big hit at the time was "On a Clear Day, You Can See Forever."
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that'll tell you about the year it was.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
He had an act which I had never seen before in my life. He even did something with like a Western thing with he had the ability to work these guns from movies he had been in, and I mean his performance was just riveting. From the beginning to the end, and all of the acts that my mother would take me in to see, no one ever, you know, compared to what that man did on stage. But you raised another comment when you were talking about Ocean's 11, and I remember my father was a big fan of Sinatra, and we went and saw that movie, and after seeing Sammy, I got very angry because, if you remember in the movie, he was stereotyped as he was the garbage truck driver.
Oh, yes.
Where everybody else had all these, you know, roles. Sammy was, you know, hanging out at the yard, and he was going to sing a little blues with the other truck drivers.
Right.
But I was probably in junior high when I got to see this guy. Mm-hmm. And when you were talking about it tonight, I have just never forgot the performance. Ever.
Yeah. Will, how about that? Yes. This picture of the complete performer, but also this the role in Ocean's 11 and other of these films.
Yes. Well, I mean, in that movie, he was driving that truck with the garbage, but it also was the truck with the loot. So the joke happened to be on the audience. The man who didn't have rights, who was a truck driver, had all of the money. And so I thought that was very interesting. And yes, Sammy on stage had a wonderful quick draw act, and that came out of vaudeville again. He taught himself how to quick draw, and he loved it. A little cowboy, that's what he was, a little cowboy. I also liked that, to draw guns when I was little. I had a pair of six shooters, and when I was five years old, my mother, she would call me into the house when Sammy Davis Jr. was on the tube, and there I was twirling my guns at the rare black cowboy on TV, Sammy Davis Jr., who was twirling his guns right back at me. It was a wonderful moment.
And in fact, he carried a pistol, didn't he? And he also carried a knife hidden in the tip of his umbrella.
Yes, he did. Yes,
and he had to.
He was afraid that he would be killed. And we must really realize that he lived in a time when people were murdered. JFK, Robert F. Kennedy, Martin Luther King Jr.
And men who were with white women were especially vulnerable.
Yes.
We're talking with Will Haggard, author of In Black and White, The Life of Sammy Davis Jr. In the background is a live version of What Kind of Fool Am I from 1965. How do you remember Sammy Davis? What made Sammy dance? Did he break ground for African-American performers or perpetuate old stereotypes? Join the conversation at 1-800-8255. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point.
An empty shell, a lonely cell in which an empty heart must dwell. What kind of lips are these that lied with every kiss, that whispered empty words?
This is On Point. I'm Jack Beatty, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about Sammy Davis Jr.'s lonely life behind the showbiz veneer. How do you remember Sammy Davis Jr. with his white Rat Pack friends, white starlets and wife? Was it fair for critics to call him an Uncle Tom? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking with Will Haggard, author of a new and infectiously readable biography of Sammy Davis Jr. Will, we're going to begin with a clip from the 1969 film Sweet Charity, directed by Bob Fosse. In the film, Sammy played Big Daddy, a cross between a black country preacher and beatnik guru who appears in a psychedelic dance number. Big Daddy is at the center wearing a tunic and a headband.
Gather round! Yeah, this is where it's all happening, babies. The rhythm of life. Number 7 in the top 10 religions.
Well, we're going to climb to number 1, Big Daddy.
I'm here, baby. But dig, time is running out on that big LP called life. And the greatest disc jockey of them all is going to come and take us by the hand and lead us to the flip side of life called eternity.
Eternity.
That big coffee break in the sky.
Yeah, but before we groove that final date, before we head for that last chung-chung-chung-chung, the 8 bars, we gotta make our peace.
Make it, Daddy.
Make it, Daddy.
You know I'm gonna make it. And I want you cats to listen to everything I'm gonna lay on you as of this point.
Sammy Davis Jr. in the 1969 film Sweet Charity. Will Haygood, give us a gloss on that performance.
It was wonderful. Sammy's best movie roles, like this role, involved movement and music. In Porgy and Bess in 1959, he played Sportin' Life. A lot of movement, a lot of dancing, a lot of singing. I think when Sammy could dance and sing on the screen, he was a knockout. It is a shame that not enough movie directors found such roles for him, which is why I think his film career was so uneven and made him so unhappy.
Mm. He's playing a preacher here, and this raises the question of his inner life, his spiritual life. He converted to Judaism. When was that, and how did it come about?
In 1954, Sammy had been in a car accident and lost his eye. Now, many of the people who came to the hospital to see him happened to be Jewish. Many of the people running the movie studios happened to be Jewish. Sammy, thinking about this, wanted to join that club. He was very sentimental in the heart. Often his heart, his sentimental heart, told his mind to do certain things. And Sammy woke up, and this was very innocent on his part, very naive, and not really very realistic. But Sammy wanted to be Jewish. He thought now he would truly be in with Hollywood. Many people looked at it slightly suspicious, me as well. And it was just another avenue that Sammy thought he could go down that would lengthen his career in the lights.
Mm. So it's suspicious in that sense that this wasn't a spiritual awakening coming out of his accident. Rather, it was partly an affectionate gesture toward his friends, but partly also a calculation that I'll have a longer career if
right.
I'm Jewish.
Right. I'll go where most of my fellow entertainers have been. Tony Curtis, Jerry Lewis, Jeff Chandler, Jewish men. Who had changed their names. Sammy wanted to join that club. I think in a way he thought it might lighten his skin color. That's a very sad part of his life. He once told a friend of his, he said they were sitting around somebody's home at a swimming pool, and Sammy said, "Wouldn't it be great if we all could jump in and come out the same color?"
Mm.
And Jess Rand, his friend, looked at him, and Jess Rand is white. He looked at Sammy and said, "No, Sammy, I don't think that would be a good idea at all." But Sammy, when he finally came to the civil rights movement, I think he came with his heart humming in a very genuine way. I think in the 60s, I think he found out who he was. I think he found out more about his history, more about the history of his people. He went to Selma and during the Selma March, and Harry Belafonte had to talk him into going. Sammy was afraid and didn't want to go and tried to weasel out of it. And then Harry Belafonte said, "But Sammy, the people in Alabama need to see you. They will get so much from you." And Sammy went. And on the last day down there, he walked over to Harry Belafonte after seeing these poor, very desperate people who didn't have the right to vote, who were threatened, who were being killed. Sammy walked over to Harry Belafonte, and Harry Belafonte looked down at him, and Sammy said, "I want to thank you very much." And he was crying. He had tears in his eyes.
Let's take a call. JP is calling from Green Bay, Wisconsin. Hello. Welcome.
Hello. Thank you. I grew up with my grandmother in the 60s, and she didn't have much use for television. But, boy, when Sammy Davis Jr. come on, Ma wanted everybody to sit down and be quiet, let me tell you. But in light of the fact that he didn't go to school, I'm just wondering what path he took to learn how to read and write, and also in light of his contributions financially to the civil rights movement, I'm just wondering if you could comment on what type of businessman he was. Thank you.
Good questions. Will Hagrid.
He had friends who taught him how to read. I was able to track down a score of actresses who were white, who knew Sammy very well in the 50s and the 40s and helped him learn how to read. Plus, he was a seeker. He took field trips when he was in his 20s and 30s. He went to factories, and he wanted to see how automobiles were made. He was very curious. So not having had schooling, all his life was spent in one big classroom, and his classroom happened to be the whole world. As far as money, he spent it when he didn't have it. And this hurt him later in his life. But he came out of vaudeville with that feeling that I can spend $10,000 this week because next week I'm going to be able to make it back. And so he spent money that he often didn't have. So, but that was just how he was raised.
A Tale of Two Presidents, briefly, with Sammy Davis Jr., tell of that poignant and painful moment at the White House where President Kennedy really did him an injury.
Yes. Sammy Davis Jr. in 1961 married May Britt, a Swedish actress. And in 1962, Sammy was invited to the White House. Louis Martin, who was black working there, had put Sammy's name on the list. Somebody kept scratching it out. Louis Martin kept putting it back in. Sammy showed up with his wife. And then President Jack Kennedy did not expect Sammy would be there. And he starts walking down some steps, and he sees Sammy and his wife, and he all of a sudden starts thinking about the South, where he has vivid support, and what might these Southerners think of this scene. And it was President Kennedy who said there must not be no photograph taken of Sammy Davis Jr. and his white wife here at the White House. And there was not. And Sammy found out about it, and he was very hurt.
And Mrs. Kennedy went upstairs crying.
Yes, she was very hurt, too, because she would not go and tell Sammy to leave.
No.
She was very hurt, and that was a painful moment in his life.
I'm looking at a photograph of Sammy Davis Jr. hugging an extremely awkward-looking Richard Nixon at the 1972 Republican Convention. This was the photograph that would haunt him.
Yes, it was. Nixon was not liked, and that's putting it mildly, by very many blacks. But Sammy had met Nixon in 1955 in a nightclub in New York City. To Sammy, once a friend, always a friend, he could not understand the historical pain that had gone on where he didn't look. And now he was supporting Nixon, who was supported by states' writers. It was a photographic moment heard around the world, and he was reviled for many, many, many months, even years after.
And yet, many
black entertainers didn't understand why Sammy was there that night.
Why was he there? The sense of,
well,
Nixon had been a friend.
Yes. Nixon had been a friend. And plus, Sammy, the kid who had never attended school, had been a guest in Nixon's White House. Now, for a kid who never went to school, who never had a chance, I mean, that was a big moment. In the Lincoln bedroom, there's Sammy Davis Jr. and his wife eating. I mean, and it meant everything to Sammy Davis Jr. to be able to walk into the White House and sleep at the White House. Completely different treatment than Kennedy.
Yes, indeed, a completely different treatment. He was treated with some respect, even if you could say Nixon used him.
Right.
He used him, absolutely. But he also respected him.
He did, absolutely. It was a strange pull, these two men, Nixon and Sammy. They both had demons, and they both were searchers and seekers, and they both knew how to use people, and they both were shrewd, and they both were actually children of California, the land of make-believe, the land
of
movies.
On that note, Will Haygood, thanks so much. We just greatly enjoyed talking to you. Will Haygood, staff writer for The Washington Post and author of In Black and White, The Life of Sammy Davis Jr. We'll leave you tonight as Sammy Davis Jr. left the stage after hundreds of performances. Here's Birth of the Blues. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point.
It's about that time, I guess. We'll be wrapping it up. So, George, let's do the one that we always do. Oh, they say my people long ago were looking for a different tune, one that we could croon as only we can. We only had the rhythm, so we started swaying to and fro. We didn't know just what to use, but this is how the blues, I said the blues.